Recordings has started.
All right, great. Thanks, Marie. Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all, and welcome to the review of all rights protection mechanisms and all GTLD's PDP working group call on the 23rd of August, 2017. In the interest of time today, there will be no oral call. We have quite a few participants online, so attendance will be taken via the Adobe Connect room. So if you are only on the audio bridge today, would you please let yourself be known now? All right, thank you. Hearing no names, I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I will hand it back over to Phil Corwin.
Hey, thanks, Michelle. Phil here. Thanks, everyone, for joining us on this late summer Wednesday. Is anyone on audio only and not in the chat room? Okay, hearing none. Anybody have updates to statement of interest? Okay, so we are we have one main and overarching agenda item today, which is continued discussion of the draft collated trademark claims data protection data proposal, not protection, sorry. Had GDPR in my head. And my recollection is that we just did a quick scan of this document at the end of last week's call. We really didn't get into any of the substance of this 11-page document. Well, hopefully within the next 90 minutes we can get through its 11 pages and agree on this data proposal. I'd also note for the record that I'm the only co-chair on the call today. Kathy Kleiman had notified us quite a while ago that she had a conflict, and J. Scott Evans, something popped up with him about 30 minutes ago, and he's not able to join us. So I'm it for the leadership today. So let's take a look at this document again, which is a proposal from the co-chairs that describes various methods and approaches that can be used to collect the data recommended by the sub-team. And we're seeking a review and feedback. And the first section lists the refined charter questions specific to trademark claims, followed by sources identified for possible data collection. So let's get into it on page 2. And let's go through each question and then stop once we review the sources suggested by the sub-team and other possible data sources, and then resolve each question in turn and then move on to the next. And I note that question 1 runs from pages 2 to 4. So the main questions are the overarching question is the claim service having its intended effect, which I think we're all in relative agreement that the intended effect was to deter infringing registrations of new TLDs. Subpart A, is it having its intended effect of deterring bad faith registrations and providing notice to domain name applicants? And B, is the service having any unintended consequences, such as deterring good faith domain name applications? And Mary, I see your hand up.
Yes, thanks, Phil. Hi, everybody. This is Mary from staff. So, Phil, just for the benefit for those who may not have been on the call last week or who haven't caught up with the various action items, I hope it'll help to note that last week when we started just with that quick overview, as you said, you know, we had noted first that we would not be duplicating what the analysis group has already done. So whatever it is that the staff would be collecting, we would use as far as possible and go back as far as possible to the analysis group's data that they've already used. And that secondly, for this question 1A, so where we are on page 2 here, number 1, we had gone back and looked at what we are able to do, and we have started putting together essentially an Excel spreadsheet that would pull down all the URS cases that were filed. I think we are able to do it up to the middle of this year, so say June 2017. From that, we can probably look at sources such as Whois data, and then we would be able to find out not just obviously what the URS cases were, what domains were at issue, and what the results were, but when the domain was registered, and figure out if that corresponded to a claims notice period for that GTLD. I think what I said last week is that that would not tell us whether there was a corresponding TMCH registration, but since we're talking about evaluating the claims period here, it would show us which and how many URS cases corresponded to domains that were filed during a particular claims period. And the final point I'll note here is that I think it was George who had suggested last week that we might also be able to extend the same kind of collection and analysis to UDRP data as well. I think that's kind of where we were up to, and like I said, hopefully that helps. Thanks, Phil.
Okay, and Mary, to clarify, you're talking about UDRP data for UDRPs brought against new TLD domains, not all UDRP since the program launched, correct?
Yes, Phil, that's I think what George had suggested. At the moment, we're just focusing though on URS.
Okay, and can't we presume that if a claims notice was generated, there had to be a corresponding registration in the TMCH since claims notices are only generated when there's an attempt to register a domain that's under current rules, that's an exact match of a term in the TMCH. So I think even though I think we can pretty well presume that there was an underlying and corresponding exact TMCH registration.
Phil, this is Mary again. To do that, we would need to know whether or not a claims notice was generated. And we would not, as staff, have that information. I think the limit of the information that we would have from this data collection would be whether the domain registration happened during a claims period. We wouldn't be able to extrapolate from that, yeah.
Okay, I see. So we cannot be sure if the registration took place during the claims notice period, then a claims notice should have been generated, but we have no way to validate that the registrar actually did so.
That's correct. Not without information as to what claims notices were generated.
But we'll probably presume that most registrars hopefully perform their duty under the obligations here. So anyway, back to question 1A. We're trying to differentiate between URSs that were brought against domains which presumably should have received a claims notice prior to registration versus those which were registered after the mandatory claims notice period, and see if there's any meaningful differentiation that would indicate the effects we're looking for. We're going to do further data crunching of the analysis group data, even though it wasn't asked directly focused on the questions we're addressing. It's nonetheless useful. And that takes us into page 3, and then I'm not going to read everything in these boxes. I don't think anybody wants me to do so. We'll presume that you can, you've either read this in advance or can scan it. And then for question 1B, we're going to look for anecdotal data from registrants or domain name applicants who receive claims notices. Here the comments are that it's how do we get this anecdotal data? Can we use a survey? and noting that a survey of registrants is also part of the Sunrise data collection exercise, and consumer survey evidence, perhaps via Amazon Turk or online survey group, and we're going to probably need professional assistance with this and other types of surveys for the data we're trying to collect, and we have to decide if it's going to be separate or combined with other surveys. And then item four at the bottom of page four is a survey of registrars on a number of questions, including abandonment rate, anecdotal data, when the trademark record is downloaded, how this might affect pre-orders, and how that process is handled. And this also calls for another survey where we may need professional assistance. And that's it at a high level. So does basically we're looking at a combination of further crunching of analysis group data that may be informative on these questions, combined with one or more surveys of both registrants and registrars to try to uncover further data, and we're probably going to need professional help in designing that survey. And, George, I see your hand up. Please go ahead.
George Karikos, the transcript. On page four, question number four, or point number four, where it has the survey of the registrars, it seems to be assuming that the only cost of the TMCH is the abandonment itself, that there are no other related costs of the TMCH. And so perhaps a broader question might be to ask the registrars whether, for example, the TMCH generated higher customer service costs and any other burdens on them. And so that would be a contributor to weighing the costs and benefits of the TMCH.
Well, you know, George, these I have to respond. These questions are focused on positive and negative effects of the claims notice.
Right.
So the TMCH is kind of one step removed from that. I'm not personally sure that it would be appropriate to ask those kinds of broader questions in surveys focused on the impact of the claims notice.
Okay,
we take that under advisement.
George, again, but perhaps it could be more focused then in terms of asking whether the claims notice generated additional support costs and any other costs that it created for them. Because the way the question is phrased right now, it seems to be premised on the idea that abandonment is the only measurable cost of the TMCH, and I would say that that's very limiting, that there are probably other costs associated with the claims notice that aren't being captured by these questions. Thank
right.
You.
Well, again, I think that's because these questions are focused on the claims notice and not the TMCH, which is a foundation of the claims notice. We're trying to find out two basic things. Has it been effective in deterring registrations that were intended to be infringing? And has it, undesirable extent, deterred registrations that would not have been infringing? So any further comments on question one from anyone else in the working group? And I see Mary's hand up again. Go ahead, Mary.
Thanks, Phil. This is Mary from staff. I wanted to draw the group's attention to the bullet point on the top of page four, which is part of the number two in this chart for question one, and where the sub-team had said that they need to see if we can find more granular data about the percentage of those who abandoned registration attempts after a notice. When we looked at this from the staff perspective and looking at it for data gathering, you'll see in the second column that we're asking for guidance as to what this means essentially how we can get that. So, A, what does this mean? What kind of data? And secondly, should that be part of the broader registrant survey? Thanks, Phil.
Yeah, and thanks for pointing that out, Mary. I have my own personal doubts that we're going to be able to get that kind of granular data. And I'm not sure, unless it's by happenstance, how we're going to stumble across registrants who abandoned their registration attempts after getting the claims notice, who are going to tell us whether their attempted registrations were for dictionary terms or for distinctive trademarks, noting that, that the possibility of infringement is, of course, higher with trademarks, so not determinative. If the trademark is in itself a dictionary word and only for certain goods and services rather than a unique non-dictionary term. But any further comments from members of the working group on the approach to data gathering for questions 1A and B? This is your last chance to speak up. Otherwise, we're going to move on to question 2. Mr. McGrady.
Thanks, Phil. Paul McGrady here. Thanks, Phil. Paul McGrady for the record. I guess it's fine as long as we are going into this with the realization that, as you said, it seems highly unlikely that we're going to get to any data from would-be registrants who abandoned their attempted application, whether that was attempted registration, whether that was for you know, being made aware or at least being in some cases confronting the reality of what might happen if they register a domain name consisting of a trademark, or on the other hand, if somebody was chilled, you know, that they were chilled. It seems since we're only surveying registrants and not would-be registrants, we're really not going to get to that information. And I doubt also that even if we were able to survey would-be or nearly registrants, which we can't, but if we could, that anybody would necessarily say, yeah, I was planning on cyber squatting but got cold feet. So, you know, this is fine, and I think it's a fine exercise, and I am a person who believes that, you know, more data is usually a good thing. I just don't think that this is going to be a survey that ultimately answers the question, which can't be answered in this particular PDP because the data was not collected up front. Just a note about how, you know, the utility of this. Some utility, but not probably not what everybody is hoping for. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. And I wouldn't disagree with any of that. We're going to get probably imperfect information. I think that argues for employing a professional survey designer to maximize the possibility of getting useful data while noting that one of our recommendations will likely be that more data gathering be built into, to the extent it's feasible and cost-effective, to any future rounds of new TLD, so we won't be in a similar situation. Well, not we, but some future review group looking at the efficacy of these mechanisms won't be scrambling so hard to find ways to come up with useful data. So, and you've still got your hand up. I assume you're done unless you want to comment further. So with no one else weighing in, we're going to move on to question 2. Question 2 is, if the answer to 1A is no, that is that it hasn't, the claims notice hasn't been very effective in deterring infringing and registrations are not as effective as we would have hoped, or the answer to 1B is yes, that is that it's had an undesirable effect of deterring legitimate potential domain registrations. What about the trademark claims notice and or the notice of registered name should be adjusted, added, or eliminated in order for it to have its intended effect under each of the following questions? I'm going to comment personally right here. I'd hope we could amend this introduction so it would say in order for it to have its intended effect or to reduce any unintended effects, so that we're dealing with both 1A and 1B. And, George, I see your hand up. Go ahead.
George Krikos again. At the beginning of question 2, it says, if the answers to 1A is no or 1B is yes, are we waiting to do the analysis, the data collection for this question after we've actually looked at question 1, or why are we collecting the data on this before the answer to question 1 is answered? I think it seems as though this section is dependent on question one, whereas the data is actually being collected now. Like, why are we dealing with question two now?
You know, George, I think we're probably dealing with it because we have a limited amount of time and need to do as much simultaneously as possible so we're not all on this working group for the rest of our lives. Mary, your hand had gone up and then down. Did you have anything to say on this, or should we just proceed with the get deeper into question two? And I saw another hand pop up, and there it is, Christine Duran. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Christine, and I was one of the co-chairs of this sub-team. I think one of the things, if you'll notice, there's a lot of data gathering in question one and not so much in question two. And the intent when we put this together was that much of the data would be gathered in for question one, and question two actually goes to the recommendations. So the original charter question was all about recommendations. People saying, should we extend, should we shorten, should we cancel? And so what the sub-team wanted to do was to back up and ask the preliminary questions, which is what's good, what's bad, what's working, what's not, what's the data. So that's where question one came from. Question two is essentially the recommendations section. After looking at the data in question one and analyzing it, now we're going to address in turn the four different sort of recommendations or suggestions that came out of the original charter questions. So that's really where that came from. So you'll notice that the sources and the questions discussed under question two are not very comprehensive because it's really more of an outcome-based question. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. That's useful background. Mary, you wanted to chime in?
I did. Thank you. This is Mary from staff, and I think this may be a natural follow-up from what Christine just said, which I think I heard about half of. So I just wanted to provide a staff update on some of the comments in this table for question two. In starting some of the data collection on the URS cases, we find that, as I mentioned earlier, we're able to actually pick up the URS cases up to very, very recently. So this means that we can supplement where the analysis group stopped. I think they stopped sometime in 2016. That doesn't alter the fact that we probably, as per the comments here, would not need to have additional data collection for this question two for the reasons that Christine has just articulated. So in other words, from the data collection perspective, it would be pretty much the same data that we will be collecting for you as part of question one. And then the last thing I'll just note here, Phil, is that he will never say this, but I just wanted to particularly call out Barry Cobb, who as a contractor and member of staff has been very helpful in pulling together some of these data already. Thanks, Phil.
Okay, so staff is already working to generate some of this data based on the analysis group data that's already been completed. So we're going to try to use the analysis group data we already have to address, to look at the whether there was a significant spike in registrations that then were subject to URS. And I noted it also that this question two in the first block also contemplates possibly looking at UDRP cases filed against new TLDs. And so we're just going to use the data as best we can to help us decide whether changes should be made in the duration, scope, or language of the claims notice. So any further comments on question two and the one explanatory box below question two? Any further discussion? Well, then we're going to move on to question three, and I note that we're just at about the 30-minute mark, and we're halfway through this document, which this co-chair finds very encouraging, noting that we could hit a snag on the next page, but let's see. Question three, does the trademark claims notice to applicants meet its intended purpose? Then a couple of subparts. If not, is it intimidating, hard to understand, are otherwise inadequate? And if so, how can it be improved? Does it inform domain name applicants of the scope and limitations of trademark holder rights? If not, how can it be approved? And are translations of the claims notice effective in informing applicants of the scope and limitation of trademark holder rights? And then sub-question 3B, should claims notifications be sent only to registrants who complete the domain name registrations as opposed to those who are attempting to register domain names that are matches to entries in the TMCH? So just a couple of personal observations, which is that a lot of this is not really data gathering but qualitative analysis and policy massaging that we're going to have to engage in based upon whatever conclusions we can draw from the data that we have. And if we went with 3B and go into sending notifications only to completed registrations, I think we'd be shifting the purpose from deterring bad faith use rather than bad faith registration, because if bad faith was intended, the registration already would have taken place at that point when the claims notice was received. And I'm going to stop sharing my personal views and call on Christine to share hers.
Hi, thanks. This is Christine again. Another clarifying point, just in as a reminder, and I'm looking in the comments section under this. So I think that perhaps I maybe failed in making sure that this answer was complete, because I think, and those of you who are on the sub-team with me can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that we actually did want to suggest that the claims notice be presented to average Internet users for their opinion. And it says, i.e., a survey. I know we said survey a lot. But really just sort of a general, you know, just somebody doing outside research saying, hey, if you were presented with this, what would you think? And ask a sampling of sort of general Internet users around the world. And maybe it's through some sort of a, you know, click thing. I don't know. And so I think that was one of the outcomes that we wanted, and I apologize that did not make it into the source column, and I'll take ownership for that error. And then I think also following up, if you look down in number two there, where it says, note that a sub-team member, top of page 8, had suggested that for question 3C translations, the survey should include registrants from different regions. So I do think that sort of poll/slash survey was the sub-team's intended recommendation, and I apologize for that not being clear in this document. Thank you.
Okay. Christine, let me ask, if we were going to undo the type of surveys you just discussed, one of general Internet users, potential domain name applicants, to get their kind of visceral reaction to the language of the claim, and another one for non-English speaking users, how would we locate, how would we select people to be surveyed, is a question that immediately leaps to the front of my mind, at least.
So, yeah, this is Christine again. Thank you. I just know that in my experience in various businesses, including even here at Amazon, there are a lot of third-party vendors who are lined up and are willing to find survey populations based on any number of criteria. So there are people whose entire job it is to find survey respondents located anywhere in the world and have them take surveys and get responses. So I think that we totally can find people who have or would be or are interested in being domain name registrants, who participate in the Internet and are willing to answer a few questions, you know, for some sort of, you know, reward or something. I don't know what ICANN would be able to offer, but I think it's available. Thanks.
Okay, so you think it's available. Of course, we'd have to inquire into the cost, because we're going to need ICANN to fund some of this survey work if we feel it's necessary to engage in. So the discussion below and the sub-team, other than for brand owner and registrant surveys, which was discussed further on, didn't suggest any specific sources. However, it did develop questions that it thought would facilitate the working group's response to question three. So questions for our consideration, and those questions are: what's the correlation between domain names registered during the claims period and subsequently subject to a UDRP or URS, and how many disputes filed in response to registrations during the claims notice period were found in favor of the complainant. I would presume that most work, because that's the usual pattern in URS and UDRP cases, more are decided for the complainant. Then the respondent, in part because the complainant usually brings strong cases and not marginal cases when there's a filing fee involved. Personal comment there. And then further discussion, it appears the subteam suggestions seems to be more analytical deductive, but could be based on data gathered for question one, which is similar to the comment I made a few minutes ago. And then it, in comments, it notes the suggestion that the claims notice could also be selected to a statistically significant sample of average Internet users to get their opinion. And then in item two, which is a potential survey of brand owners and or registrants regarding any cease and desist letters that were sent and received, noting that we'd have to develop appropriate survey questions and need to decide if we need professional assistance and the best way to reach out to these target groups, and noting also that INTIS provided some feedback and that this could be combined with a brand owner registrant survey that's been suggested as part of the Sunrise data gathering effort. So overall, what I'm taking away from this is that a lot of the qualitative kind of policy analysis work and recommendation needs to be done by us on a subjective level, but based on as much hard and reliable data as we can get. And I'd say it's clear we need to move on quickly from forming these questions to deciding what surveys we need to undertake and getting on with them as quickly as possible to get that data that's required for us to make some decisions and recommendations down the road. So, as I stop to take a sip of water, does anyone have any further comments on question three? Okay, I'll take that everyone on. Oh, Christine, go ahead.
Hi, just because it's simpler than typing. This is Christine.
Sure.
Looking at the chat, the people talking a little bit about sort of what a survey might look like, in addition to sort of trying to figure out what the perception of the claims notices was from actual attempted registrants or applicants, we also, as the subteam, wanted to really get into the perceptions of the claims notice itself. So, yes, of course, you know, we want to know exactly about how it worked in the specific new GTLD program today. But part of the goal was to actually present it to people that maybe have not yet attempted to register a domain name. But if you were to attempt to register one, what would you feel about being presented with this notice? So that's a little slight variation that I wanted to make clear, just kind of based on what I've seen in the chat. So we're not only looking retrospectively here, we're looking a little prospectively as far as making recommendations in the future. Thanks.
Okay, yeah, thanks for that further input. I'm just thinking out loud, but I'm you know, and I'll leave it to the professionals who identify target groups for surveys, but we're probably going to need some existing customers of registrars would seem to be a good target group. Some have registered new TLDs and may have new TLD domains and may have received a claims notice, and some only have legacy or CCTLD domains, but at least they have some familiarity with the domain registration process as opposed to the general population. Despite the large number of total domain registrations, in the world is still a very small percentage of total global population. So going out to the general public may not be very useful on this. Question four. This is about exact match requirement. Is it serving the intended purpose of the trademark claims RPM? In conducting this analysis, recall that IDNs and Latin-based words with accents and umlauts. That's a new one for me. Someone's going to have to explain that to me. Are currently not serviced or recognized by many registries. And what is the evidence for harm under the existing system? I assume that's harm to rights holders in this context. Should the matching criteria for notices be expanded? There are some subparts. Should the marks in the TMCH be the basis for an expansion of matches for the purpose of providing a broader range of claims notices? What results in unintended consequences might each suggested form of expansion of matching criteria have? What balance should be adhered to in striving to deter bad faith registrations but not good faith applications? And what's the resulting list of non-exact match criteria recommended by the working group? If any, if an expansion of matches were to be implemented, should the existing claims notice be amended? Editorial comment, completely personal. I would think we'd have to amend the language of claims notice if it was generated by non-exact matches of different types, but that's my personal opinion at this point. So that's the questions. Of course, I'm going to note in passing that we have a detailed proposal for a range of options for further non-exact matches that was submitted by Greg Shatton and supplemented by others, and we're going to get back to that at some point in our deliberations. But right now we're talking about whether we need a broader base of possible incidents that generate claims notices. I presume that would be based on a finding that the existing claims notice was not doing what we felt was an adequate job of deterring bad faith registration. So in terms of the data gathering, let's look at the explanation, the explanatory comments, which run for the rest of page 9 and into page 10. For 4A2, I missed 4A2, which is, should the claim period differ for exact matches versus non-exact matches? So for 4A2, which is that question, reports or articles discussing the harm of type of squatting and other forms of non-exact match cyber squatting, including all forms of consumer hurt, not just traffic redirection. This subteam has suggested using research help to identify such studies, reports, or articles. And noting that this information had been compiled immediately by ICANN staff following identification of the source material. I don't know how far along we are with staff attempting to do that. For 4A1, which is whether the existing claims notice should be amended, if we go to all right. You know, I got to say I'm confused here. When I look at question 4, there is no 4A1 or 4AI. There's simply question 4, and A, B has subparts I, double I, triple I, and IV. And then D similarly has I and 2. So, Christine, could I call upon you to tell us what this is actually referring to? Because there is no, in the question, 4A has no subparts.
Hi, this is Christine. Looking at that, I think there's actually just maybe a typo there. 4A is just the question about evidence of harm, and there were supposed to be two different ways to get at that. The first way to get at that was sort of an empirical look at articles and reports that have been published and are available. And the second way is some sort of survey of brand owners, possibly referring to the INTA survey, et cetera. So I don't know that this was necessarily intended to be 4A1. I think that could possibly be a typo. Apologize.
Yeah, those seem to be typos. We're just talking about 4A, which is what is evidence of harm, presumably harm to rights holders on the existing system, and the sub-team as proposed identifying already published research studies and reports, and supplemented by a survey, again, where we need to decide if we need professional assistance and then secure funding for that. And noting that INTA has given some feedback on this. For 4B, I'm going down to discussion point 3, which is about expansion of the matching criteria. The contractor would be required to create semantics of programming that can be used to test the historical data to see how many claims notices may be generated. I assume that's by each potential class of non-exact matches. That's another one where we would need professional help. And then for 4C, this is discussion point 4, and that's the feasibility of implementation. Again, we need assistance from a contractor to research the technological options for creating a non-exact match system. I think we had, in the initial discussion we had of the Greg Shatton proposal, we had noted that some of the proposed classes of non-exact matches could probably be implemented through software or other technological means, but that others would require some qualitative human judgment, and that, of course, would be more costly and subjective. So wrapping up on question 4, we need a lot of professional assistance, and we need to quantify what we need and get a request up to council that consolidates all our survey needs and other analytical needs as soon as possible so we can get moved forward as quickly as possible. So is there further discussion on question 4? Okay. All right, we're 48 minutes into the hour, and we're approaching the last question. And the final question is, should the trademark claims period continue to be uniform for all types of GTLDs and subsequent rounds? And then in the source, it notes that one sub-team member suggested surveying registry operators as to whether they think something about their business model should exempt them from claims and why. We'd need to develop appropriate survey questions and comments. Will there be any business confidentiality issues, and will this be separate from any other survey? You know, I think there's some disconnect between the question, the text of the question, and the explanation, because the text says the claims period, but discussion below seems to be indicating that we're not really looking at differentiating between the lengths of the claims period, but actually whether there should be any claims period at all for certain new TLDs. I assume those would be restricted TLDs where, for example, dot bank, where you must be a regulated financial institution to be considered as an applicant and to be rejected if you're not, and that type of TLD probably wouldn't get attempts at infringing registrations. Christine, your hand's up.
Thank you, Christine. Again, another clarifying point. I think what we meant to say there were all aspects of the claims period, such as must there be one? How long should it be, and to whom should it apply? I think the question really came out of a discussion, much like what Maxim has just entered into the chat. Currently, brand TLDs do not need claims, he says. It says not all TLDs were created solely for sales, GOTLDs, community TLDs. So, again, you go back to this idea of are there some business models, like you said, Phil, dot bank, et cetera, where the model is such that it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's an additional cost burden for registries, registrars, and registrants to have to deal with claims when the model is, you know, super restricted or somehow otherwise regulated. So I think that we just wanted to leave that an open-ended question because every other question sort of assumed that it would all be uniform and applicable to everyone. And specifically, let's say that we do decide that claims period should be perpetual for, you know, GTLDs. Should there be an exception then for other forms of TLDs, like maybe GOs or something? So the point does it make sense to make the entire claims process be non-uniform? Should there be categories or separations or distinctions? And we will never know that, I think, until we come out with our recommendation of what we think the normal or the status quo should be, and then we can decide if there should be any anomalies and what those would look like. But that's in there as a placeholder for, you know, once we make the recommendation, you know, we need to think about is that recommendation going to be universal? Thanks.
Okay. And thanks for that, Christine. And thanks, Maxim, for pointing out in the chat that we already have one category of new TLDs, which is not subject to the claims period, which is dot brand. So I think really the question is whether we wouldn't be breaking new ground here in creating exemptions to generation of the claims notice. We'd be considering whether those classes of exemption should be expanded. So anybody have further comment on this question, which I think is worthwhile? If trademark owners don't think certain types of new TLDs require the claims notice, that's fine, and potential registrants wouldn't receive claims notice. So given the other restrictions, the opportunities for infringement are probably far less than in open TLDs. So any further comment on question 5? Okay, then any further comment in general on where we go from here in terms of coordinating as expeditiously as possible the creation of all the surveys we're going to need for our various data gathering efforts and getting that request up to council and through ICANN as quickly as possible, because clearly a lot of our work is going to need to wait on that additional data to some extent. And Paul McGrady, please go ahead.
Thanks, Phil. Paul McGrady here. Just a very general note that I thought today's call was extremely productive, that we kept ourselves out of our ideological loops and polarized positions and really went through this document in a very cooperative way. And I just wanted to make a note that, you know, some days we're frustrated with each other, but other days, like today, I think was a great example of the multi-stakeholder model working the way it should. And Phil, great job on the call. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. And, you know, it's like any other these working groups, like any other relationships, some days they're very sunny and happy, and other days there's some conflict, and you got to get through the conflict and then move on and get back to an even keel. But I think we've discussed this data proposal to the maximum extent we can, and we need to get on quickly to survey identifying professional survey assistance and getting on with that data collection. Jeff Newman, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. This is Jeff. Just to clarify something in the chat. So you said the request needs to go to council. I just want to clarify that what's going to council is the request for money or resources or whatever. But council's not going to do the survey questions or anything, right? It's really just a request for resources. Can you just confirm that?
Yeah, that's my understanding, Jeff. I see Mary's hand up. She can better explain exactly what steps we have to engage in to get professional assistance in designing this and undertaking the surveys we've identified as necessary to further work by this working group. Go ahead, Mary.
Thanks, Phil, and thanks for the question, Jeff. Yes, that's absolutely right. The request going to the council would really be for the resources that are needed. It would need to have some details, so we'd have to explain what it is that we're trying to do, justify why we think we need professional assistance, say, in survey design, and provide an estimate of the costs and so forth. But the council would not be reviewing the substance of the questions. By way of background, especially for folks who have been participating in the GNSO for a while, this is a new requirement that came out of the work of the Data and Metrics for Policymaking Working Group, I think it was 2 years ago now. And so now in the procedures, there is a form and a process for requesting this kind of budget and resources. And on top of that, the idea is that this will feed into more data-focused policy making. So at the end of this, at the end of our phase one, and at the end of our overall PDP, one additional requirement that you may be interested to know is that working groups are encouraged to identify metrics that can be used for reviewing the success of a policy down the road. So while this is going to be, I think as everyone knows, a very massive data collection exercise, there is a reason for it, and hopefully it will feed into a more robust framework for policy review. I see, Jeff, that you have asked whether we need a formal council motion. I think that is up to the council. One thing to note is that this will actually be the first time that any working group has used this new process. What we do know is that the council's deadline for any sort of documents for its meetings, we're talking here about the September meeting, would be for that meeting 10th of September. So we've already given a heads up to the council leadership, and presumably if they need a motion, that motion would be proposed by our council liaison, which is Heather Forrest. So hopefully that's helpful. Thanks, Phil.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. And I'll just note for the working group's information that the while they're not on the call today, all the co-chairs have a call scheduled on Friday, which is twice its usual duration. We usually have a 30-minute planning call. We've scheduled an hour for this Friday because we have quite a number of issues we have to resolve, and certainly moving forward with the survey request so we can get it on a council September agenda is going to be high on our list for this Friday's discussion. And with that, unless we're at the 59-minute mark and we have completed today's agenda, I'm going to ask staff to tell us I think we know what our next steps are, which is to develop that survey request and get it before council in September. So, staff, is our next meeting at the same time next week, and does staff have anything else they want to inform us of before we wrap up today's call about 30 minutes early?
Hi, Phil and everyone. This is Mary from staff again. And unless Michelle corrects me, I believe our next call is the rotating call, which would be the call that's more friendly to the Asia Pacific time zone. So that would be 0300 next Thursday UTC, which for North American participants would be your Wednesday evening. I just wanted to note, Phil, as well, that based on last week's conversations, the intent for next week is to begin discussions of the results of the INTA cost impact survey. So our anticipation as staff, having looked at those results, is that that could take up, say, two meetings of the group, but that the idea is to start it next week. And following that, we should have some of the initial data gathering done for the group to then consider as the council is considering our request for professional assistance. So there will be quite a lot to do even as the council is considering our request for professional resources. Thanks, Phil.
Right. We won't be idle the next few weeks, that's for sure. And Lori Shulman is not with us today. We'll be on next week's call to explain the INTA survey. So unless there's further comments or questions, we're going to adjourn today's meeting and thank everyone for participating. And please remember that next week's call is the Asia Pacific time slot. So thank you and enjoy the rest of your day. Bye now.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks, everybody. Goodbye.
Thank you. Today's meeting has been adjourned. Operator, please stop the recordings and disconnect all remaining lines. Have a great remainder of your day, everyone.